Blog Talk Radio.
Chain with your host, Yvonne Mason, which is moi. Tonight's music is brought to you by my guest, Dan L. Hollyfield, and the name of that particular piece is Indistinguishable Magic. Now, before I really get introducing my guest, I just want to say that I met Dan through a former guest, Stephanie Osborne, who I had on way back at the beginning when the show started, and she is also an author. Dan wrote some pieces of music to go with her Sherlock Holmes books, The Misplaced Detective. So tonight is Dan's night, and Dan is, he says he's not interesting, but he so lies. It's the southern rearing that we have that we don't think we're as interesting as we really are, because we have been taught as Southerners we don't self-promote ourselves. Well, I grew out of that real quick, and I'm going to teach Dan how. He was born in November of 1957 at almost the same moment that Sputnik 2 was launched. Now, the two events are not in fact related, but there could be a book about it. His father was a machinist graduating from the General Motors Institute in the mid-1950s. And after running away from the harsh cold winters of Michigan for a return to the family's ancestral home, Dan's father began working in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, making toys for the physicists to play with. Dan's mother's an artist specializing in oils, china painting, glass painting, and multimedia home crafts. Now, when the SATs, which is the Standardized Aptitude Test, were introduced in Tennessee elementary schools, it was revealed that Dan had a reading level of a 10th grade student. Unfortunately, he was only in the third grade at the time. In the fourth grade, he was finally allowed to go to the school library, where he checked out two books, Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth and H.G. Wells' Omnibus, which contained five of Wells' most famous novels. Now, any of you who have read H.G. Wells or Jules Verne, that is not easy reading. I've read both of those. One more standardized testing occurred later that year, and fourth grader Dan had risen to a 12th grade reading level with a timed reading speed of 400 words per minute. However, he's never been any good at sports other than dodgeball. Even later than that, his family moved yet again, and this time to Athens, Georgia, where he has lived in and around Athens for the remainder of his life. Welcome, Dan. Thank you for coming on my show, because it is going to be a fun and interesting show.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're quite welcome. Now, where shall we start with all of these goodies that we have on tap? First of all, explain to the audience, because inquiring minds want to know, because I'm sure a lot of our listeners weren't even a twinkle in their father's eye when Sputnik was launched. So explain to our listeners what Sputnik was and why we sent it up.
We didn't. Sputnik was a Russian satellite.
Russia,
it was a series of
right.
Russian satellites.
Yes.
And Sputnik 2 is the one with the little dog Laika, the first living being from Earth that ever went into space. Unfortunately, she was on a one-way trip, and there were no provisions made by the Russians to bring her back. There was no reentry possible for that teeny tiny thing that she was in. If you look it up and read the history, it'll make you cry. It really will. But from all reports, the people that worked with her and her trainer and one of the scientists that was in charge of the project, she was a good dog. She was very patient, very loving, very quiet, and that's one of the things that they were looking for. Originally, she was just a stray dog from the Moscow streets, and she got found and got taken in and got raised up a bit, and then she made history. And my mother went into labor just about the same time over in here in the U.S. I was born at McLaren General Hospital in, I think it was Detroit. It was either Detroit or Flint. We lived in Flint. And my dad was up there to go to school at the GM Institute to be a machinist. And his first job was on a GM automobile manufacturing line. I think he was making 56 Chevys, probably Bel Airs, because he bought one. And one of the best cars we ever had, that 56. It lasted for decades, but that was one of his favorite stories to tell, how he got that job and was building these cars and everything. But it really wasn't challenging enough for him, so he decided to apply for a job at Oak Ridge working for Union Carbide. And he wound up working at the Bull Run Steam Plant, which is a coal-fired plant, but it was part of the Knoxville Nuclear Belt, which is what I like to call it, because it's down there. We had a neighbor across the road in Clinton, Tennessee, where we moved to, and he worked at the Y-12 gas diffusion plant, which is part of the process of making nuclear bombs. And, I had an interesting childhood. I remember, I was 3 years old when we left Michigan, and I remember watching Captain Kangaroo, and my parents started me out with coloring books and teaching me to read, and flashcards and teaching me stuff. Some of my coloring books were, there were identical things that would have a page in French, a page in English, and a page in Spanish.
Wow.
So, yeah, well, I at that time, yeah, I had a slight vocabulary in three languages, but now I can muddle along in English, and I can read college-level French, and I know enough Spanish to order a burrito at a restaurant, but that's about the end of it right there. I didn't keep using it. There wasn't any reason to back in the 50s and 60s. So, my parents always bought me books. My dad would take me to Knoxville, and we would go shopping, and he would buy me a Tom Swift Jr. book. And I'd go home and read it and read it and read it over and over and over again. And I would read comic books, and I would read the little big books, if you're old enough to remember
those. I remember those,
I read about 100 of those. And Reader's Digest was always a big part of the family entertainment. And watching Walt Disney on TV back when TV only had three channels in the U.S.
I remember those days.
And it was one of my jobs to go outside and redirect the antenna so that we could watch the Sunday night Grand Ole Opry or something. Oh, Lord. I remember when Dolly Parton first came on the Porter Wagoner show. That was years and years and years ago, and listening to Hank Williams Sr. a live broadcast from a local radio station, I think it was in La Follette or something, as we were driving from one grandmother's house to another. And then, go right ahead.
How in the world, when the teachers, because you and I talked about this briefly, when it was found out that at 8 years old you were reading at a 10th grade level. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you got to understand, when Dan and I were in school, at 8 years old, they were barely allowing us to read full sentences in these very elementary books, which to Dan and I were boring as all get out because our minds didn't work that way. Now, I don't know about you, Dan, but we had to read in a group. We had to sit around in a group, and we had to wait our turn to read. Well, by the time it got to my turn, I was already at the end of the book because I was bored. I mean, when you're sitting there.
Oh, yes.
See Johnny run down the street. Jane ran with Johnny. Well, I'm already at Johnny's house. So I can imagine where you were. You've done been to Johnny's house and Susie's house and George's house.
Pretty much, yeah. And found out that I had no aptitude for basketball or baseball because Johnny and Dave and Robert just continually whoop me at everything. But I got really good at not getting hit, so I was fantastic at dodgeball.
You probably did a mathematical equation as to the odds of getting hit. So while they were busy trying to pick a target, you were already out of the way.
I'm afraid math and geometry are they were Dad's territory. The man could work a pool table, and he could do complex calculations in his head without needing a slide rule, which was the closest thing to a calculator that anybody had back
right.
then. When it comes to doing what he was doing as a machinist, to be able to think in numbers and just let them do all the work for you before you ever picked up a piece of metal and put it in your lathe and set it to exactly what you needed to carve out a part for something. That's a talent that's just beyond me. I mean, quite frankly, I'm dyslexic.
I have
trouble remembering a phone number. And, well, I can remember all the numbers in it. I just don't get them in the right order.
And do you have trouble when you dial the number, you see the number on the paper, and then you go to dial the number, you transpose the number as you're dialing it?
I have learned over the years to do things in short steps.
Mm-hmm.
So I can get it without too much of a problem. But my mathematics go somewhere, but there's this plateau at balancing a checkbook, and then it leaps over everything in between to elementary algebra and quantum physics.
I understand that.
Everything in that gap is gone. I can't look at it and make any sense of it. And you can imagine what somebody with dyslexia can make of algebra. It's
and
numbers.
Yeah, and you want me to figure out who X is? I divorced him 20 years ago. That's who X is. I mean, come on.
Really? We're not interested in finding your ex. Quit whining about it. Grow up.
I don't even want to find my own. So what makes you think I want to find yours?
And what's really weird is in my job at work, I have to think in algebra sometimes to write a spreadsheet so that the computer does all the math from me from now on, so I don't have to do it anymore.
Thank goodness for spreadsheets. Now,
oh Lord, thank goodness for computers. Best thing that ever happened to me was a computer.
Amen. Now, in the 12th grade,
let me explain the thing about the reading levels.
Okay.
This was a brand new concept. They come out with these standardized tests, and they put the entire school, and this was a kindergarten through 12th grade school, and they put the entire school through all these tests, and they added up everybody's scores, and they're in the fourth grade. They divided people up according to their reading level, and they had the people that needed help in one group and the people that were right on target for their age group in another group. And they had the people that were kind of advanced a little bit beyond what was expected of somebody that age in another group. And then they had the four of us, which were in a high school reading level. And I had the highest one in the whole school.
Wow.
And then, and by the end of the year, they did another test, and I had progressed so far that apparently I was a high school graduate reading level, and here I am. I'm just reading stuff at home. I'm doing my classwork. I've got these history books. My parents have a full set of Compton's Encyclopedia.
Love this.
I had already read through what was it, Milton's Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained, because Mom had copies. I had gone through books of fairy tales, the Grimm's fairy tales, King Arthur stories, some other mythology from around the world. And they finally took me to a library. The entire fourth grade class went to the library. And I just looked at these books and I go, I can take some of these home and read them? And they go, yeah, that's why we're here. You pick out anything you want and we'll fill out this little card that tells you when you have to be through with it and bring it back and turn it in. And we'll do this once a week. And, they even had speed reading stuff. They came out with in this big classroom with a projector that would show you a page from a book. I think it was a Dickens novel. And there was this little black thing that masked out everything except for one set of words at a time, and it would scroll down the page back and forth across the entire line, across and then down to the next line and across and down to the next line and across, and the teachers would speed it up a little. And we'd keep reading along with it, and the teachers would speed it up a little and reading along. Finally, they reached the end of the scale for the little knob that would speed it up, and it was 400 words a minute, and I was keeping up.
Wow.
Yeah. And it doesn't sound real to me, but that's my life, you know. It wasn't some overnight thing.
Not only do you speed read at 400 words a minute, but the retention of what you read, because before the show, you were telling me that you had told your nieces a story sitting under a tree. Tell our audience that story.
Oh, well, it was a holiday weekend in East Tennessee. The Smoky Mountains were almost close enough to reach out and touch from our grandparents' yard. My nieces were just sitting there bored to tears. We were supposed to leave the grown-ups alone so that they could, work in the kitchen and do this, and the men folk would be watching TV and whatnot, and the women would be gossiping in the kitchen, and they didn't want the kids underfoot. So we went outside, and my nieces were kind of, well, I wouldn't say hyperactive. Somebody might say that nowadays, but back then that didn't exist. They were very bored and wanted something to do, and I just, let's sit here and I'll tell you a story. So I started reciting J.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit from memory. And
now, ladies and gentlemen, if any of y'all have ever read Tolkien's work, it is intense, it is wordy, it is
almost poetry.
Yeah, it's prose and poetry. And this interesting man is reciting this book to, and he's a child, reciting this book to his nieces from memory.
I was in high school at the time. I had just discovered Lord of the Rings. It was the same era that I discovered the Allman Brothers Band, Grand Funk Railroad, and Jethro Tull, and let's see, what was the other one that was so... Oh, well, it doesn't matter. Memories, I can get swamped in them. And I had borrowed a copy of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings from a girl that I was in school with, and... I read them, it took me a day and a half per book, basically, to read them the first time. And every time I reread it, it got a little faster. My mom bought me a copy of Dune. That's one of my favorite short stories. It's only 800 pages. A short story is defined as something you can read in one sitting. Well, I sat and read the whole damn thing. I've got a copy of Dune that I keep in a Ziploc baggie because I read it so many times. The cover fell off and the pages were falling out.
Oh, my word.
Oh, yes. The only other thing I've got like that is an old copy of Agatha Christie's Murder of Roger Ackroyd, but it was falling apart when I bought it. Now, my mom had, by the time I was graduating high school, my mom had just about every Agatha Christie that had ever been printed in paperback.
And that's another one that can be difficult to read if you're not used to reading English literature.
And that's one of the reasons why I admire Stephanie so much. She writes mysteries, and those are hard to do.
Mm-hmm. And without giving things away.
Oh, yes. Well, you have to foreshadow a little bit. Otherwise,
right.
People are going to think you just pulled the solution out of thin air.
But it's
you have to have the clues there. But you can't make it too easy. It's not like it was Encyclopedia Brown. Now, that was another thing that my parents did all through my school life. You remember Scholastic books?
Mm-hmm. I do.
When your English class would give you this catalog of books that cost 30 and 40 and 50 cents in paperback,
mm-hmm.
and you'd take that home and beg your parents to buy this and buy that. I would be the kid with the biggest box being shipped from Scholastic books. Because my parents would indulge my reading.
And luckily for you and me both, my mom as well encouraged my reading because she was a reader. And she did not censor my reading because she was not censored as a child. She believed that in anything that we read, if we read with an open mind, we have the availability to learn something, no matter how stiff it is, no matter how dry it is, no matter how boring it is. If we open even schematics, if one opens one's mind, one can learn something. And I've always been grateful to her for that.
Now, I have always been grateful to my parents for everything except flashcards. That gave me.
Well, that helped with the memory.
But it gave me performance anxiety. Now I can't. If somebody's looking at me or looking over my shoulder, I freeze up because Daddy was bound and determined I was going to be a mathematical genius, and we'd have these flashcard sessions where I'd learn my multiplication tables and division, addition and subtraction, and I cannot do that stuff on command.
I can't either.
I really can't. I really can't. And God bless him, but he tried too hard.
Now, I have a question for you before we run out of time. You played several instruments in high school. You played trumpet starting in fifth grade.
I played trumpet, and I played, I think it was my sophomore year in high school. We had too many trumpet players and not enough of everybody else. And the band director asked me if I would mind terribly switching to French horn. And I did that. And French horn is a real departure from trumpet, mm-hmm. but it's also kind of similar. Trumpet is a right-handed instrument. French horn is a left-handed instrument with a trumpet. Your embouchure, where you're holding your lips, the tension and everything else changes which octave you're in. With a French horn, you almost don't need the keys.
That's true.
It's like a bugle. It's like
uh-huh.
a bugle. You can do all kind of stuff just with how tight your lips are. And how much pressure you're putting here, there, and everything. It's muscle control more than anything else. And I was in the marching band. I was in the concert band. And while we had it, I was in the jazz band. And somehow or another, I had gotten hold of an old guitar amplifier. And it had a microphone and a distortion pedal. And we'd do this jazz band stuff. There was one really fun song to play, which I can't remember the name of right now. But it was a lot of fun. It was a big challenge. And I'd stick that microphone into the horn of the French horn, into the bell, and hit the distortion box during the big brass fanfare in the middle of it. You know, basically, with a modern-day song, you'd call it the bridge, where you go to a something that's totally different, but then you go back in for a final verse and chorus to end the darn thing. But in the bridge, I would just show off a little. And the band director let me get away with it. It wasn't because I was so good. It was because I was audacious. You know, I was daring to do something different. One of the last year or so in the marching band, we had a guy on the sidelines playing electric bass. And that was fun. He even, when we were out doing marching routines in the middle of the football field, he would march back and forth in this little square as far as his guitar cord would let him go. Yeah.
This history brings me to my next question. Because you were introduced to marching band and concert band, did that pique your interest in creating beautiful music? Because you were also in several garage bands. You were in you played rhythm guitar, keyboards, messed around with drum kits. Did that position to create your own music like this, indistinguishable from magic music that we played before the beginning of the show?
It did, and that basically, when you're hearing the Displaced Detective Suite that I wrote for Stephanie's books, you're hearing the result of somebody being given classical music lessons from the end of fourth grade, fifth grade year, on up through high school graduation. And we started off with something as simple as Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star when everybody first got their band instruments back in the school. It was on Chase Street in Athens, Georgia. It was the same elementary school that DeForest Kelly went to when he was a child. And, of course, not at the same time as me. He is several years my senior. But we'd go on and we'd play different classical bits, and then there were some fun stuff that it wasn't exactly pop music, but it was the pop end of classical music. And then went to a different school in Athens, and there was more emphasis. They had not only a band class, but separate from that, they had an orchestra class. Now, I was in the band class. I wasn't in the orchestra. I was in the chorus for 1 year and found out that my voice is not baritone, but not quite tenor. So I was in this awkward place when my voice was changing. And then you get to the stuff that's in Displaced Detective, and you hear violins, and you hear oboes, and you hear flutes, and you hear harps, and you hear viols, and you hear contrabassoons, and all these classical instruments, and then this rock guitar kicks off, and this drum kit kicks off, and I'm mixing and matching stuff, and
we have a caller. Hold on.
Oh, we do.
Yes. Hello, this is Yvonne. Who am I speaking with, please?
This is Ed. I am a friend of Dan's.
Well, hello, Ed. I'm glad you called in.
Well, I was listening, and I figured I'd call in and show my support for Dan.
Well, thank you very much.
So, I am one of the people that Dan helped launch a career as a writer through his efforts at Aphelion.
We were just going to get to that. I'm glad you brought that up. Since Ed is on here, Dan, explain to the audience what Ed is talking about.
Well, okay. I first started writing stuff down, trying to make little stories when I was back in school, over on Chase Street, actually. And then fast forward a few years, and computers had been invented, and I had written all kinds of outlines for things on my mom's old Smith Corona typewriter, and here I had a word processor. So, you know, I made an attempt at a story. It wasn't a very good one. And then fast forward to when I got a better computer, and one of my very good friends talked me into going online, and I was very much against the idea because I'd heard of these things called computer viruses, and I thought they were very dangerous and would be very expensive to, get a. If you got one, you pretty much your computer was ruined, and I quickly found out that was baloney. About 1995 or so, I got online and I was sending out short stories to these different creative writing websites, and I got a couple of things published. I got involved with a website called Dragon's Lair Webzine, and I went on all these internet chat channels. They're kind of like bulletin boards were back way back when, but you sit there and you're just typing to each other and all this. And I was trying to find different writers that would be willing to try and contribute stuff that would be enjoyable for people to read and this, that, and the other thing. And the guy that was running Dragon's Lair made me assistant editor.
Wow.
Just for doing publicity work, you know. And trying to get the word out. So I had to write an editorial for each issue, as well as try and keep my stories going and things like that. And then after a couple of years, somebody said something really nasty to him about the quality of his work, and he got depressed and shut the website down. And there were about half a dozen different writers who had serialized stories that weren't finished. So I asked him, well, look, I can take over. I can do this. And he goes, no, I'm going to close down the website. If you want to do it, you make your own website. I'll send you everything. You can start your own place. I'd never want to do this again. So I did. And my friend that drug me online kicking and screaming helped me out immensely because he's much more internet savvy than I am. And I learned how to write web pages, and I learned a few rudiments of editing, and I became the publisher and senior editor of Aphelion Webzine. Now, I borrowed the name Aphelion from the University of Georgia Science Fiction Fan Club, that I had been just close to, and just some of the best friends I've ever had for all the time that I was in college. And they put out this quarterly printed 4 to 8 page fanzine that they would mail out to people all over the world. And it was called Aphelion, which is kind of or a little pun on far out, because aphelion is a distance that is furthest in a planet's orbit from the sun. So naturally, when I got a chance to do my own webzine. I called up the guy who was the one who was the biggest influence and the driving force behind the college groups at Peatland, and asked him for permission to use the name. He said, go for it. So I did. Now, for the first couple of years, it was pretty much a one-man band. I did everything. I did the page layout. I drew cartoons. I did the editing. I proofread the stories as best I could. And after a couple of years of that, it was just about more than I could handle. And I was going, I can't do this anymore. I've got to the point to where I'm not editing anything. When somebody sends me a submission and I like it, after I've read it, I'm just putting it online. I'm just doing the HTML and putting it online. I'm not doing these people any good. And lo and behold, a bunch of my friends got together and said, no, you're not going to be allowed to shut this down. We will become your editorial staff.
Wow.
And they did. And Epelion has been a presence online since February 27th of 1997.
And it is still
next
there?
Next February will be our 20th birthday.
Wow.
And
this is how you got Dan? Is this how you got Dan involved? I mean,
yeah, Ed submitted stories and you know, it's just kind of took off from there. We have helped almost 200 writers now turn pro.
Wow.
And
that's wonderful.
At least two artists as well.
It goes well beyond that for me. Yeah.
So
I submitted to Filion as a writer, and then I became Dan's Flash Fiction editor. And now I run Sheepjack Pulp, which is a quarterly web and physical magazine, and I'm the co-host of the Nitty Gritty Writing Podcast. And I went from nothing to all of that through my tenure at Epelion.
Well, we need to get you on my show, Ed.
That would be fine, but I called to support Dan, but when he said he just had some people that went pro, some people had gone through and actually gotten some serious measures of success.
Well, see, that's what happens when you call in to support, because we pay it forward around here. Dan called in to support Stephanie Osborne, who was on my show as a writer, and he's co-writing with her, and he's written the music for Displaced Detectives. So he got a slot on my show. So because you called in to support Dan, I want you to get a slot on my show. Dan, isn't that how it works?
Ed, resistance is futile. Prepare to be assimilated.
As long as it started by supporting Dan. Dan is the Dan's kind of in certain circles. He's the grand old man of certain circles. There's probably no one that's more helpful on the amateur circuit, especially in some areas, than Dan. I mean, just that he keeps the site up and running is worth more to some people than God knows what.
If someone wanted to join your circle and to contribute, where would they find this?
Oh, well, it's easy. You could go and Google my name, or you could go and Google Epelion Webzine. And that's the simplest way to find the website, because we've got this big, long URL. You can go www.apelion-webzine.com, and that will take you straight to the cover photo, and one click away from reading my monthly editorials, and another click after that, and you can dive in to the actual contributions by the people that are so talented that keep popping up. I mean, what I do, I pay for the website, I keep the darn thing online. I let the editors do what they do best. I don't interfere. And people just flood in and give, they send submissions, and it's like they're surprised that the editors go, you know, this is pretty good. There's a problem with comma splices that you might could work on. Have you thought about doing this, or have you thought about doing that? And maybe this character needs to be a little bit stronger. Could you rewrite this paragraph so that this one has a little bit more force and things like that? And the editors do all the work now. I mean, I used to do it all by myself, and I wasn't the best in the world.
But what your editors do, instead of taking the red pen and just slashing it all to pieces and causing a writer to get that self-doubt, which we all do, it sounds to me like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds to me like your editors encourage your writers to be stronger and to be better and to excel at their craft.
That's what we're here for. That's why so many people have come and gone on the editorial staff. It's this joy in helping somebody learn what it takes to put this stuff out there and get better and get better and get better, continually better, and then turn around and submit something to a place that actually pays you and get a letter of acceptance instead of a rejection slip. Now,
exactly.
I've a long time had a policy, ask for rewrites before giving a rejection. If a writer refuses to do a rewrite on something that you know is wrong with their story, then they probably don't have the temperament to keep working and working and working, because it is a process. You're not just born Stephen King. He had to work at it.
Well, you know, Stephen King threw his first manuscript in the garbage. He threw Carrie in the
garbage.
Yeah,
and his wife rescued it.
Exactly. And had she not rescued it, well, we wouldn't have Stephen King. Some of his work, maybe we don't need, but Pet Sematary, my all-time favorite book that he ever wrote. It was the only thing that I enjoyed that I read by him, because it was three-dimensional, it was human, it was flawed, it was just well-written.
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't
funny. Yeah. And he has a book out on editing and writing. I think it's called On Writing. I'm not sure. But it helped me immensely. But the thing that got me, there was a fellow in the University of Georgia Sci-Fi Club by the name of Tom Dietz. And he started off as an artist. And I believe he was trying to do illustrations for Catherine Kurtz, if my memory serves me correctly, and the book never happened. But he had written stories and sent them to her just to read, and she advised him to polish them and submit them. And he was my first editor.
Wow.
For the paper versions of Apelion. And he was going through one of my stories and going, let's see, red pen that, you need to rewrite this paragraph. This is the wrong word. I know what you meant, but this word is not the correct word. And about halfway through, I stopped being discouraged, and the light bulb went off in my head. He was improving the story. This is what editors are for, to show you how you can improve what your original inspiration was.
Well, as writers, and Ed, jump in here, as writers, we get so deep in the weeds, we know what we're trying to say, or we know what our characters are trying to say, but we get so deep in the weeds that we don't always get that three-dimensional effect.
I found, can you hear me? I found out that when I was working for Dan, I cannot edit my own stuff. It's completely different mindset as a writer and an editor. It's almost like being a different person when you're looking at someone else's stuff. So when you look at your stuff, you automatically miss everything that your editor's eye would pick up.
Exactly.
That's the stumbling block. When you look at your stuff, you look at your own stuff, you know what you wanted to say, and you automatically put that on the page that you're reading when that's not what you typed. It's what's in your head.
You could be completely different kinds of editors. The fellow who was Flash Fiction editor for Dan that I took over for, John, actually works with me now on my zine. He was a very good line editor and proof editor. I found that I'm a better developmental editor. So I can line edit and copy edit, but I actually found myself as an editor and what kind of editor I was working for Dan, and learned to differentiate my strengths and weaknesses as an editor at Affilium.
So not only did you help Dan, not only did you help Ed with his writing, but you also, in that context, helped him develop a new craft and understand that he was good at that particular part of editing.
I wouldn't be an editor or an editor in chief. I wouldn't have anything to do with editing, period, if it wasn't for Leon. I had no desire to edit, no aspirations, no vision of editing at all. And this is someone else's words, which I'm not always comfortable with. Another thing I learned from Dan is the humility. I've got the biggest token payment physical zine going in some circles right now, and that was something I had never even envisioned or wanted or had any semblance of vision of before I took an editing position for Dan. Because no one else seemed in line, and I was all I was eager. I wasn't experienced. I was not prepared. I was eager, and I took what I fulfilled a need, and cut my chops at Dan Zine, and now you flash forward. I've branched that off, and it's almost like Affilium had a baby.
It's not the first one. We've had several writers turn around and publish their own zines and go off in their own directions. And it's just like I always say, the best and the saddest thing that can ever happen is when somebody has come to Appelion and sent us stories and just blazed into light, and they've found the direction that they want to go in and started off on their own projects, and we get that email that says, "Hey, I sold something," and I go,
"I'm leaving."
Great. That's wonderful. Now we'll never see you again.
I want to know when that happens, and I want to know when editors come and go, because in my experience, it seems like you never really let go of anybody. Everybody that's been around seems to stay around, at least 80% of them. All the editors have been given emeritus status and still interact, and I say most of the authors stick around too. I want to know who actually leaves.
the thing in the indie industry that we are all involved in, and ladies and gentlemen, the more you listen to my shows, the more you're going to hear this. As indie artists, authors, musicians, writers, this is how we operate. This is what we do for each other, because this industry is a hard industry to get into on a good day. And if you don't have any self-confidence, then you need to go either find some or get in another line of work, because this thing will consume you. It will eat you alive if you let it. But on a different note, we all support each other, because our philosophy is we are only as successful as we help others to become. Dan, am I right with that statement?
Oh, exactly. Exactly. My talent is not micromanaging.
Right.
When somebody comes and says, look, you need a short story editor? Let me give it a shot. And I go, okay, it's all yours. And I won't tell you who to accept or who to deny or anything else. I've got a couple of rules. Ask for rewrites. Don't absolutely reject somebody unless they're one of those writers that thinks that their words are carved into stone and nobody has the right to change a single punctuation mark. And we have had a couple of those. And we waive them goodbye and wish them well. And
because they will never go anywhere.
Oh, some of them have, some of them haven't. There's been so many. I mean, we have been online for 20 years. We have the archives are absolutely full of everything that's ever been published except for the stuff that writers have sold and asked us to remove. We've got the entire history of the e-zine on there. Now nobody's updating the archives now, and that's a big problem. We had a fellow who undertook a project to go ahead and do nothing but archives, but then he found other stuff that he wanted to do, so he stepped away. There's just so much work to being an editor. You can't help but burn out after a while.
That is true. Now, we're getting down to our last few minutes, and at the end of every show, if you can do it in a minute, if someone comes to you and says, I have a dream, but I'm too busy or I don't have time, what would you tell them? And tell me what you would tell them in about 30 seconds.
If you want it done, you need to knuckle down and do it. Put your butt in the chair, put your fingers on the keyboard, and do it. Don't let your everyday cares and your work schedule and everything else interfere with trying to find what you're good at. Go ahead. Give it a shot.
And Ed, you can weigh in on this. At the end of the day, at the end of our life, when we're laying there and someone says, do you have any regrets? And you say, shoulda, woulda, coulda. Ed, is it too late?
Well, go back to Star Wars, what Yoda said. There's do or not do. There is no try.
And with that, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, this is Off the Chain. I am your host, Yvonne Mason. My guest tonight has been Dan Hollifield. I told you he was interesting. One of his proteges, Ed, who came to support him, will now be on my show because we believe in paying it forward. So, Dan, I will get with you after the show so that I can get Ed's information. And y'all don't hang up when the show goes off because we'll talk a second.
Okay.
Tomorrow night, Friday night, my guest will be radio host Floyd Potts. That will be definitely Off the Chain. Live your dreams, ladies and gentlemen, whatever it is. If you want to be a garbage collector, be the best damn garbage collector out there. Live your dream. It is important. We only go around once. Dan, thank you so much for being on the show. Ed, thank you for calling in. It was an honor. It was a privilege. And I appreciate you guys so very much. So, ladies and gentlemen, until tomorrow night, remember, this show is always off the chain. We never stay on script because there is no script. And this is... host, Von Mason. We'll see you at 8 o'clock tomorrow night with Floyd Potts. Okay, the show is now off the air, but whatever we say now, if people listen to the archives, they will get this part of the conversation. But I didn't want you guys to hang up because I wanted to tell both of you that when the show goes into archives, it automatically goes up on iTunes, it automatically goes up on Stitcher, and then I will upload it on Spreaker, SoundCloud, MixCloud, Podcast.com, Podomatic, and Hipcast. And when it goes up on Spreaker, it will go up on TuneIn Radio and on YouTube.
Wow, terrific.
So what I will do...
She does a lot of work, Ed. She does a lot of work.
You do a daily show?
I have about 5 shows a week, yeah. Plus I'm an author.
Wow.
Plus I have a disabled husband.
Wow. Five shows a week is something in and of itself. Yeah.
It ain't nothing but a thing. It ain't nothing but a thing. But what I will do, when I upload the podcast, I will post the link on my page, and I will tag Dan. Ed, I want you to friend me on my page. Go on Dan's page and find me at Yvonne Mason and friend me, because I'm getting you on the show, because you have an interesting story to tell on your own. And Dan, you're welcome. Dan, you're going to get with me and let me know when in March you're coming back, because we didn't get through half of the stuff I wanted to talk about.
Oh, yeah. I realize that. I'm a long-winded bugger.
Well,
but that's
you could do a show with me. You get Dan back on, but you also have the potential with Dan and I, and then if you could even dig up one more, to have a round table now of amateur publishers.
And we could do a 2-hour show if you guys wanted to.
Dan, I do it with just Dan. I'd be happy to. But if you could find another one, it would almost be like not a who's who, but a brain trust of people who are accepting work at a certain level and introducing people into their dream, if you will. God only knows how many people have indirectly passed through Dan's hands, and now what I did when I started mine was took the fire from that dream, and I did something that Dan wishes he could do, and it really taps me. But I actually give a little bit of money, and I pay, and I started mine with the thought of token payment, almost to take it to the next step, to give people, you know, they get the courage to write from Dan. And then a lot of times, I won't even lie, and Dan knows this, I poach from Abilion and find talent, and I say, listen, I'll give you, I send out a lot of $10 payments, $15
uh-huh.
payments. The biggest ones I send out are $40. So, that's what I decided to do personally. That's self-funded, and I lose money on it, and not everybody can be expected to do that. But it provides a slightly different insight into providing for the dream. We could do a whole show just on helping people achieve and break through that barrier.
Well,
yeah.
Dan,
that's one of my dreams. One day, either I'll hit the big time, or I will, on my monthly lottery ticket, I'll finally get one that has good numbers, and I will finally be able to pay all our writers and the staff pro rates. It hasn't happened yet. It may never happen, but it's nice to have a dream like that.
The thing is, it could happen. That when you put things out in the universe like that, that dream is out there. And things have a way of work. As the English say in historical novels, the wheel's always turning. You have good fortune. Mm-hmm. You have not so good fortune. And the wheel could turn into your favor because you and Ed both are helping so many people who otherwise might not have an avenue to write, who have a passion to write. And good things happen to people that do that.
I'm a firm believer in karma. Whatever you put out will return to you.
I started submitting, and of course I've been writing a long time, and Dan can commiserate with me here, the difference between writing and submitting and shooting for your dream can often be, there can be a lag. I submitted.
Well, yeah, look at me.
2 years ago. And from 2 years ago, now I'm an editor-in-chief, a podcast host, and a novelist. That's, you know, you talk about the wheels turning. I jumped on, and Aphelion was a big part of flinging the wheel. That wheel grabbed me and took me for a ride, and I didn't even know how fast it was going to fling me. So
yeah,
and the
other end of the spectrum. Look, I wrote the first Marin Ibrahim story in 1995. The book got published in 2015.
Well, I wrote
It took me
Ring
that
Catcher.
Long to find a publisher that was willing to take a chance on humorous stuff.
I wrote Dreamcatcher in the 1970s. My daughter was born in 1976, and I started writing Dreamcatcher in 1977. I published that book in 2007.
The trick is, don't ever give up.
No.
Whether a success comes fast or slow,
you never give up.
You're not going to get that success if you give up.
I've been on television. I've been on radio shows. I've spoken to 300-plus people. And now, after 5 years of planning, I have my own radio show. That's why I say, Dan, you put it out there in the universe, so it will come back to you.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer in that. I have been trying for so long because I was working in a vacuum when I was younger, and I'd get good grades on stuff. On an essay in English class or something.
Uh-huh.
And the thing is, everybody needs an editor. Even editors need an editor.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's one of my big lines at conventions when I'm on a writing panel. Editors need an editor. You can't work in a vacuum.
No, and you and I don't call it a handicap. I call it a challenge because I have a brother that is handicapped. That's what Dreamcatcher is about. And he's taught me that it's not a handicap. It's just a challenge. And what we do with that challenge, how we embrace it, is how we succeed. So I can sit and write a sentence, and I can look at that sentence, and that sentence is exactly what I wrote. But when my editor looks at it, she'll call me up and she'll say, "Yvonne, what did you mean?" And she'll read it back to me, and I'll say, "Kat, that's not what I..." She said, "Yeah, baby, go look." And sure enough, it's exactly what I wrote, but in my mind, it's not what I wrote.
Yeah, you can't see the flaws in your own work. Because you know what you intended to say, but what
there's
you
only,
intended to say wasn't what you typed.
There's only one thing that works even relatively on that level. I found one thing that will work at a bare-bones level for self-editing, and it's the only reliable method I've ever found to edit your own work. It's you run it through text-to-speech. And you listen back to the entire thing read by a different voice.
We had somebody at Apelion that did that. They wouldn't read a story. They'd feed it through text-to-speech
and
listen
it
to
it. That's an excellent idea.
That's the only thing that even works, and it won't give you developmental editing, but it will copy. You can copy edit your own stuff, because what it eliminates is it will eliminate most misspellings. It'll eliminate the double typing, like when you type the or do. And it will also give you some idea of if you're writing fantasy or science fiction, it'll give you some idea of if one of your characters' names is just too unwieldy and weird that when you it's spoken aloud, you're like, that's not what I really want people to have in their heads. You can change it.
That's not the way it's supposed to sound.
Right.
Let me re-spell that.
You know,
what an excellent idea.
Yeah.
And it will also show you where things don't work because you're not reading it yourself. It's being read to you. And you go, damn, that was a clumsy sentence. I need to take about four of those commas out and splice it up with some periods and things and turn that paragraph that was one sentence into 50 sentences that are much, much shorter. Oh, that's a Keith Lawmer lesson right there. Short.
Excellent.
Effective sentences.
Y'all have taught me something tonight because I've got text-to-speech on my computer, and it never dawned on me to do that. What an excellent idea.
You know, when I first tried text-to-speech, all my alien names were pronounced correctly. But my human names that are ordinary, everyday words were pronounced incorrectly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It was weird. It was really weird. Here's this stuff in languages that I made up, and the text-to-speech reads it because I wrote the stuff phonetically.
Interesting.
And
well,
then it goes on into ordinary stuff that's just conversational, and it can't comprehend. And I'm going, damn, I need to rework that page.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we're going to have to do, guys, the computer's going to cut us off. So before they cut us off without me saying a proper goodbye, because we're going to pick this up again. Ed, you're going to friend me on Facebook. Dan, you're going to give me...
Yeah, you're all set.
Okay. Dan, you're going to give me a date to set a show for you in March, and then between the three of us, we'll set a third show, but then I'll bring Ed back, so we'll set a... fourth show, because I'll bring Ed back more than once, because I can do that. It's my show. But we'll do another show on stuff like this.
Sure.
And you still intend to have me and Stephanie tag team something later on too, don't you?
Yes.
Oh. Yes. I'll let her do all the talking.
she's
much more interesting than I am.
Y'all are just now regulars on the show, so you're
well.
I do
try and listen to at least one a week, you know.
Well,
but it's sometimes 8 o'clock is hard to fit into my schedule because I've gotten interested in all the superhero stuff on the CW, and it starts at the same time as your show.
Well, you give me a night that the superheroes aren't on CW. I'm flexible here. You just
In March it'll all be on reruns.
Oh, okay. So that is y'all's assignment for the evening, and I will get all of this uploaded. I will put it on my page. I will tag both of y'all in it. That way, and my gift to you guys is you take the show and you pass it around. You put it on your websites. You let people know. Tell them that I'm always looking for guests and to get a hold of me. But use this show to market your work.
Well, all you got to do is tag me when you upload stuff, and I will share it. It's not a problem.
I could try and talk to my co-host on the Nitty Gritty Writing Podcast, but one is an Irishman living in Iceland, and the other is British, and so they're on different time zones. So
I have someone that's calling me from England.
Oh, okay.
So it's no biggie. We can do this. I was dealing with people in Canada. This is an international show. I have people all over the world listening to this show.
It's kind of like a Helion. I mean, got people in 76 countries that read this stuff.
So, let's...
Yeah, isn't that frightening?
That is frightening. So before the computer cuts us off, because we only have a certain amount of minutes after the show, I'm going to tell you guys thank you again. I enjoyed it immensely. I'm humbled. I'm very honored. And I appreciate both of you very much, and I will talk to both of y'all later.
Okay.
All right. It's a date.
All right, then. Good night, guys.
Good night. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye, Ed.
Bye.
Goodbye, Yvonne. Until next time.